I do think that God is at work in stories like that. And I actually think that, and a friend of mine, Heidi Johnson, she says, instead of those kinds of stories, they're sort of faithful, have the biblical sort of faithful Christian imagination taken to authentic storytelling, but those aren't an escape from reality. Those are an escape into reality. And that's where I try to think of my storytelling. I want it to be an escape into reality.
Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. I'm Charlie Carter, and I'm here with Tim Little and Andy Stearns. Let's jump into the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, listeners. And the Thinklings Podcast is incredibly excited to have a special guest with us for this episode. Our guest today is S.D. Smith, or Sam. Sam is the author of the wildly popular series Green Ember. Other titles from Sam are Mooses with Bazookas, and he's got another upcoming book, The Found Boys. And I like to always read from, you know, go to the horse's mouth, so to speak. So Sam's Twitter profile says this, it says, Sam Smith, I give your family soul shaping, memory making, darkness shaking adventures, which that's a well-crafted Twitter bio there. And then on your website, it says, books packed with old school virtue and moral imagination, but are not safe, but rather bold, daring, and truthful. Sam, as we were mentioning in the before we were recording part of this, lives in West Virginia with his wife and four kids. And so, yeah, Sam, thank you so much for being here. How are those country roads down there in West Virginia?
Oh, they are a little wet today. We've had some beautiful weather, but it's in that time of the season where it's back and forth. We get all four seasons in West Virginia, and sometimes in the span of like 3 or 4 days. But it's beautiful here. I love it. The country roads are doing great.
You know, I got something about those country roads. So we were at Appalachian Bible College last summer for the Bible Faculty Leadership Summit. And we were driving back, and the guy that was driving back was from Southern California. And so he set his GPS so that it would avoid the toll roads.
Oh, big mistake.
Big mistake.
Oh, no.
So we drove on those West Virginia roads, and the buddy sitting next to me after a while was just like, I'm not going to make it. Like, he was going to lose his cookies. We were having some problems. So those roads are windy roads.
They are. There's a reason why we have sort of a distinct culture from Virginia, and did even before the Civil War when we became our own state. But part of it is just like, it's hard to be out here in a way. So it's like, it was the frontier and it was mountains and it was just kind of different sort of people. And we were always sort of resentful for the agriculture and money around Richmond and that sort of thing. We weren't getting heard, you know, across the mountains here. There's definitely a distinct West Virginia culture, for sure.
Yeah. And so, Tim and Andy and I, we just kind of realized this earlier, but Appalachian Bible College is a very sister school to where we're at. And so that was a surprise. It's super fun. I think through your writing, we know we're kindred souls, but that is even more to add to it. So yeah, that's super awesome. I've never been to West Virginia. It's on my list. But tell us about your family. How did you end up in West Virginia? You know, why there?
Well, my dad said, you've never been to West Virginia. This could be troubling for you. But my dad, among the catechisms that he taught us growing up, one was, if you weren't born in West Virginia, you must be born again. So I'm not positive that's great soteriology, but that's something he used to say. And he would also teach us, you know, I'm West Virginia born, I'm West Virginia bred, and when I die, I'll be West Virginia dead. And that's something I've taken to heart. So, and he may or may not have said that, you know, at the rapture, we'll all meet together at Mountaineer Field. But there was probably a little bit of heresy in there. I'm not sure. But I grew up in Wayne County, West Virginia, deep in the woods in a holler. I don't know if you guys know what a holler is, but it's the hollow space between two mountains, you know, a hollow, but we say holler. And I grew up one of those. And when I was 12, we went to South Africa. My parents were missionaries. And so there were five of us kids, and the oldest son, actually, he was going to Appalachian Bible College, and we went to the mission field and lived there for most of my teenage years. But other than my teenage years in Africa, which were interesting, exciting, missionary kid life, really amazing time to be there. When I went there, I was 12. I turned 13. Nelson Mandela was in prison, and I turned 13 my first birthday in South Africa. He was released from prison, and wow. when I left, he was the president. So it was a wild time to be there. The first church I was ever a member of was a Zulu church, and my dad started a Zulu church with a Zulu pastor. And so that kind of grew up. That was, so I'm got this Afro-Latchian heritage, I call it. But
That's perfect.
But we're West Virginians for sure. Like, even when we were over there, a lot of missionaries sort of have the, and I get it, I respect it, like the Hudson Taylor model of trying to sort of like fit in. And yeah, I think Hudson Taylor, like, you know, tried to look as mm-hmm. Asian as possible. You know, he would wear the, I don't know, like kimono or kind of thing, and do his hair, you know, I think he grew his hair out, but all that. But yeah, I think we had sort of a different approach, like just sort of be what you are. And I think people identified with that. There was not a lot of fake, like we love South Africa. For us was sports was a big deal because we played everything here, you know, football, basketball, baseball, soccer, everything that you could play here. And we went over there, we played cricket, rugby, more soccer, that kind of thing. We just kind of jumped in and did that. Like, we loved their stuff. It was awesome. It sort of became our stuff too, but we also never forgot who we were. We still would like get VHS tapes of Mountaineer football games and watch them. And we cared, we sort of care about where we're from but loved those people and really identified with them. I sort of got adopted into the Zulu tribe a little bit, not officially, but in our local little context. And that's really important part of my life. It actually still shows up in my books. My son and I have been writing a series called Jack Zulu and the Waylander's Key. And yeah. those are based on a kid that's like his dad's Zulu and his mom's from West Virginia. So that I've always cared about those worlds sort of colliding a whole lot. Over on my wall here, I've got a Zulu shield and the state seal of West Virginia, like right over there. So that's like, that is definitely who I am, but never forgot, where we came from. And this is, I love West Virginia so, so much. We joke around about the sort of the idolatry of it. That's not really true. I hope, God help me, that's not true, but I do love this, the people and the place of West Virginia so, so much.
So I've got two final introductory things. Hopefully we'll go quick and then we'll dump. And Tim, you can be ready. We'll do the thing we always do. You can drop your sound bite.
Stand so, by.
Sam, what is the correct way to pronounce the mountain chain that you live in?
You got it. Are you right? I see you felt like you were struggling a little bit, but I think you got there. A lot of people say Appalachia. It's not Appalachia, it's Appalachia. And it's the easiest way to remember it is just say, I'm going to throw an apple at you. And if you're not saying it that way, you're probably wrong. And we look down on you as some kind of condescending outsider. We're very quick to kind of be tuned in to people making fun of us and, everybody overlooking us. If you even know who we are, then you probably know it through jokes or something. So we have our backup a little bit, but yeah, Appalachia is the right way to say it, I believe.
I'll never forget that ever again. That's perfect.
My work here is done, guys. My work here is done.
Yeah, I just realized this week, I watched a video of someone saying, everybody think it's the Appalachian Mountains, and that's not right. I'm going to talk to someone who's a native, so we'll figure that out. So officially, the Thinklings position on the mountain chain is the Appalachian Mountains. That's official. And then, so you're talking about Mountaineers. So you just hired Darren DeVries, who used to be the head coach of Drake here in Des Moines. What are your thoughts on that for your basketball team?
I mean, I'm excited. We've had some great coaches there. This is a basketball community for sure. The state, I mean, we've sort of outkicked our coverage, punched above our weight class a little bit. We've got some of the best basketball players ever played. Jerry West, the logo of the NBA is West Virginia, from down Camp Creek, not too far from here, actually really close to some of those turns that you probably took that by not going on the interstate. Yeah. That's how you get around Cabin Creek. But he was the Zeke from Cabin Creek. So, yeah, I'm excited. I hope we had one of the worst years we've ever had last year, this sort of interim coach. But, yeah, I love West Virginia basketball.
Oh, look at that.
There. But, yeah, we're excited. We welcome. We like our sports here. We don't have any pro teams, so the Mountaineers are kind of it. You know, the West Virginia Mountaineers are that's, I guess Iowa's similar, but
yeah.
You got a little bit of excitement around basketball this year too, I think. I've heard a couple of things about women's basketball.
Yeah, we've got that one girl, you know, doing some.
You beat West Virginia in the, and I'm not even going to say that it was officiating, because I mean I just don't think it's a proper venue to bring that up. But no, she's a great player. That was fun.
Awesome. Well, Tim, why don't we do that thing we always do?
Books and business.
Let's talk about some books. And Andy, you can go first.
Sure. So this week I've read the whole Green Ember series, and then I've listened to it, I think, twice on audiobooks. So I didn't have to read that to prep for this week, but I am reading Surprised by Oxford by Carol Weber. Again, Charlie, you've been reading through that. And so I know we're going to interview her later this month. And I've been enjoying it. Similarly, a very good writer. And there's just a number of turns of phrase that she uses where I'm like, oh man, that's a really good way to say that. But even at the outset, the apologetic angle is really fun. I just remember how much I loved it before. So listeners, that'll be coming in the future. But if you haven't read it, I would definitely recommend it.
Okay, books and business. So I have a book too. And I didn't read The Green Ember either in preparation for this interview. So I've been a little faulty. Memory, but I am reading Slow Productivity by Cal Newport.
Ooh, are you a Cal Newport fan?
Yeah, I love Cal Newport.
Oh, kindred. Oh, sorry, I'm cutting you off. Go ahead.
I mean, let me do my thing here. Gosh,
sorry.
Yeah, I love Cal Newport too, and I think I'm about halfway through Slow Productivity, and I think it's wonderful. I really loved Deep Work and Digital Minimalism an awful lot, and yeah, so. Excellent book. It's almost aspirational a little bit more than anything. Like there's definitely things that he's from his books that have influenced the way I think about work, and the way that particularly just like the our capacity to be distracted all the time, and how you really cannot, we think that we can multitask. We think we can write a little bit, read a little bit, check email, check Facebook, check Instagram, and that we'll be okay. But that sort of, the context sort of switching, he has a lot of terms I can't remember for how the sort of whatever you were working on before stays with you and hangs with you, and you can't really shake it without doing long, deep, undistracted work. And that certainly feels applicable to the vocation of a novelist. Really helpful guy. I love, and sort of taking it through, and like I do with a lot of these guys, sort of like taking it through sort of what I try to hopefully like a Christian biblical sort of lens. It's really, there's some awesome, common grace, awesome, great, insights that are just really, really helpful.
Slow to Productivity has been on my list to read. I like Newport's observations of life. I think he does a good job. In Deep Work, he had those like four different types of deep workers. Are you the monk where you have to like cloister yourself away? Or are you like the like hour a day kind of a guy? Like, or what do you think you are?
I can't remember.
okay.
I think I would like to be the monk, but I am not yet that. That's definitely, I would love to go that direction, but I'm more like try to get a few hours in every day of uninterrupted, if possible, 2 to 3, if I can.
So I've been reading with some guys. We've been working through Finally Free by Heath Lambert. I've read this before. I think we've even talked about it on the podcast before. But Monday nights I get together with some guys and we've been reading through our book, Song of Songs for Singles. And we finished it. So the new book that we've been reading is Finally Free. I've had some good conversations about accountability and how accountability is not a time of confession. It can be part of that, but really accountability is, hey, I'm struggling with sin. help me out. And so you reach out to somebody before you sin, and not confessing just to them after you've already done so. So Finally Free by Heath Lambert. It's a really good book. I recommend it for young men who are struggling with immorality, or even trying to help somebody else who's struggling with pornography. So yeah, that's my offering today for Books and Business.
Awesome. And so, Andy, I completely agree with you about Surprise by Oxford. I'm about 3/4 of the way through that. And yeah, just really like the way she weaves poetry and the way she's talking about, as a student of literature, how she's writing that. And so really, I've been working on that. But then, you know, not to bury the lead, I have finished Green Ember. Is the book that I just finished reading this morning, and obviously written by our guest today. And my initial impressions, and so I don't know when you guys read something new, if you instantly compare to other things, or you know, you start trying to figure it out, or you know, and I try now because of our, you know, Andy, your friend down in Georgia, you know,
George from Georgia.
He critiqued us with the Ransom trilogy that we're trying to overanalyze it. You just need to read the story. And so I tried to just read the story. And you've got a sister and a brother and a family and a nice little cottage. And then everything goes wrong. And it's a great story about betrayal and bitterness and trying to find a new life, but then courage and bravery and dealing with your fear. And oh, by the way, they're all rabbits. And so a great story. And yeah, it drew me in, and it wasn't the ending I thought I was going to get. And well, I'm not going to spoil it for any listener. It wasn't exactly the ending I thought I was going to get with it, but a very satisfying ending. And you know, it made me wonder, like, okay, I probably need to stop into Faith Bookstore today and grab the next one in the series, which I'm sure Tim, I saw you going for your microphone. I thought you were going to make a comment about that, but
hey, they're at the Faith Bookstore. We keep a good stock of Green Ember books, and even outside of Green Ember now, Jack Zulu and Mooses with Bazookas. You know, we've sold quite a few copies of those two as well. My son's read all of your stuff, my son Daniel, and my other kids have read several as well. But and if you have multiple kids, get the hardcovers, because they're going to actually last. We've trashed a paperback or two along the way.
Sam might want you to get the paperbacks, actually.
That's how I'm feeding my kids. I've seen some really beat up, like, copies of the Green Ember from that are paperbacks. That are like, if they're beating them up, then they're doing a great job. Because I've had kids that are like, yeah, I've read this like 20 times, and it looks like it's been read 20 times.
Wow, that's so cool.
And so, Sam, we do a thing where when we finish a book, we created an arbitrary scale for us to judge a book's goodness.
Oh. You're not going to judge my book's goodness right in front of me, are you? I feel like this is like Survivor.
Of course he is.
You won't get voted off the island. Don't worry.
We actually want you to turn around so I don't have to do it in front of you. But yeah, no.
I'm girding up my loins here. You're
horrendous.
I don't care what you think anyway, just ahead of time. I don't even care.
Obviously, you know, whenever Tim finished a book recently, and we kind of had our joke, like, well, we have to give it a 10, right? Because Tim's right here. But I do think this is a very good book. And I am the odd man out here. I am not married and don't have kids. But if God does bless me with that someday, this is a series that I would want on my shelf for the formation of my children, and at whatever age is appropriate for them. And I do think there's great virtue in it. I do think it's written well, and it's a great story. And so I'm gonna throw it on as an 8 on our Thinklings goodness scale. And so, which is a high mark. So, you know, this isn't like Dave Portnoy's pizza reviews, you know, where we're like super official, but one. You know, that's a high number. And, but yeah. And, I always try to quote Lewis when he talks about, you know, when you get older, you can read children's stories again. And I don't actually know the quote. You know, as a young man in my 30s, I just appreciate a story like this that is fun, but also reminds you of what's true and good and beautiful. So, Sam, thank you for writing it. And then as we get into our interview here, we are going to focus on Green Ember a little bit, but I want to open up, you know, we all here, the three of us plus you, obviously, we want to write. And so I'm interested in your writing process. And so you could think about maybe, you know, in general, or just, you know, you could focus on your writing of Green Ember, however you want to answer this. But I kind of just have a list of kind of rapid fire questions for you about how you write. I'm just going to throw them at you and we'll see which ones stick. So where do you normally write? When you write, do you have some type of guilty pleasure, like a snack you want with you or a certain type of an energy drink? Is it coffee? You know, Andy and I are, I guess all three of us were pretty big coffee guys. Do you write in the morning or the evening? And then just generally, what would be some of your best tips for writing?
Well, I would just want to, first off, I want to rate those questions, and I think I will give them a 7. I think that's probably a 7.
I love it. I love this. You just gave me a great idea. I can start ranking some of these guys's frivolities. They do this to me on a regular basis. I can start ranking them on a horrendous odometer or something.
Yeah. See, it's just turning it back on you. I mean, it's easy to sit there on the sidelines and just criticize people's game, you know. Criticism is easy, but, you know, creation is tough, guys. No, I'm kidding.
Pulls out of my back. Oh. Usually the guest doesn't come to Tim's defense. This is not good, people.
I'll take the 8.
Tim's like the puddle glum of our group, man. You just sided with puddle glum, okay?
Oh, I'll take puddle glum all day. Awesome. He's great. That's good. No, I appreciate the 8. As a person who's never won any awards at all for any of my writing, probably justifiably so, I call myself an award losing author, because it's descriptive and accurate. Because I've been runner up in a few, but I've literally lost all of them that have ever existed. So that's pretty fun. So an 8's pretty good. I'll take an 8. You know, it's not bad. Especially for the first book I've ever written. So I like that. It's changed a lot, man. You know, like having kids and being, you know, when I wrote The Green Ember, it was like insane. Just was working at least one full-time job, another job. I was kind of busy in my church and I was coaching soccer, had young kids. It was really chaotic. My father was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer during that time too. It was just a really... Well, I mean, I can't tell you all the crazy stuff that was going on during that time. It's like a... like birth pain sort of a thing, like just intense pain, like a lot of really tough stuff, honestly, in so many areas. And the fact that something came out of that, that's been a gift to other people, is just sort of like a miracle to me. So I'm super grateful for that, but that was I wouldn't go to that and say, hey, here's how to write a great book, you know, make sure your dad gets cancer and, you know, make sure you have no time and you're stressed out and you're about to go crazy and all that kind of stuff. But I think the only lesson in that maybe just is that, like, I describe myself as a green writer. I have a course called The Green Writer. And part of that is like, I have a green light. I'm not waiting for permission. I'm not waiting for the time, like the muse to strike perfectly. And oh, now I feel like writing, or that now I have enough information. And now I'm really a good enough writer. And I'm not waiting for all those kind of things to line up perfectly, because they never do. The ideal circumstances never come along. So I'm going anyway. I'm a going writer. I'm going. And I'm also a green writer, as in like a green living thing. I'm growing. So I'm not yet like what I'm going to be, but I've got to be where I am to get where I want to be. I'm becoming someone who writes generous, excellent books. That's the share is generous, excellent work. That's what I want to do. That's what I'm doing. I'm going to get better at it, Lord willing. And I'm growing. So I'm patient with myself in that sense. I can't demand perfection, which is a real paralyzing sort of way to operate. You know, if you have to have a certain, you have to have a good taste. So you have to evaluate, you know, like even the Lord or God creating the universe is creating things, and he's immediately evaluating, you know, this is good, this is good, this is very good, that kind of a thing. I think that's what we do, and that's a good instinct that we have. But if we're waiting to be the kind of creator that he is, then we're gonna be waiting a long time. So we're sub creators. We got to live with a certain amount of imperfection, and figuring out when it's the time to share, that's the tough thing, I think. And that's part of that's thinking generously, having a hospitable disposition. But as far as the making, like we got to make if we're going to ever hope to share. And so that's going to, that means we're going to be making things that are imperfect. And that's certainly the case with the Green Ember when it first came out. The Ember Rising, the third book in the main series, I would say it was an example of like a period of time that's my favorite of all the Green Ember books, because I think it's the best written. That's when I first quit my job, and I'm a sort of an anxious person by nature, and I'm conservative, cautious. So quitting my job was like a huge leap of faith in a lot of ways. You know, we sort of have like a traditional family arrangement where my wife has not worked outside the home ever. And so it's like, it's on me. And as far as provision, you know, I've got four kids but leaving my job at that time, the Lord just answered so many prayers during that period of time. And I had so much peace. And I did two things for many, many months. I built a fire pit, like with my friend, and so we were out there like lifting rocks and moving gravel and like getting to use his cool like backhoe sort of stuff. And then I wrote Ember Rising. And that time was just, I don't know. And I took walks, and it was just like a peaceful time, a surprisingly peaceful time in what could have been really chaotic. So those are like two contrasting times of writing. But every book has been different, and every circumstance has been different. I think one of the main things is just sort of showing up and doing it, showing up and being present and being like, and taking it on. I think it's the easiest thing in the world for writers to do is to not write. And I'm so good at that. I'm like the best in the world at not writing. And I think most writers are super good at that. But it's just tough, you know, and habits. I think you guys talk a lot about habits. It seems like you're tuned into that, even with your questions and stuff. So that's been a powerful tool for me. And did you say where I write, Charlie? Was that your question? And
yeah, where, when, you know, are you a coffee guy?
No, I don't. I know that people are like coffee. It's like, coffee is the number 2/1 religion, it feels like, with guys. It's like a coffee drinker, coffee addict. I'm like, you're literally putting your addictions out there for everyone to see. But no, I'm not a coffee guy. I drink tea occasionally, but I'm mostly water. I like water a lot. Sometimes I'll drink Coke, like a Coke or something, or a Sprite, but usually I like water a lot. But right here in this little office, it was like a garden shed sort of a thing. And I just turned it into a little office, and it's great. It's real small, but I call it the forge because I'm a smith, you know, that's where I do my work, out in the forge. And, I've got,
that's really cool. That's really cool.
It's a nice little place, you know, it's good. It works. It does the trick. morning. So when I'm in a good routine, like right now, our little company, which is myself and my brother and my brother-in-law, have our little publishing company, and it's called Story Warren. And we publish all my books. We're just now releasing our first non-SD Smith book, which is a hilarious, wonderful book called Team Burger Shed by Tavin Dillard. If you don't know who Tavin Dillard is, you should look him up. He's just a hilarious, kind of clean comedy kind of a guy, just really so funny. but we just announced his book a couple days ago. And then Jack Zulu 2, my second book with written with my son, we're going to release on or announce on here coming in a few days. So probably by the time this is out, Jack Zulu will be out as well. Jack Zulu 2 will be out. Anyway, during that time, it's a little bit like all hands on deck. It's, you know, it's chaotic. It's like a lot that's going on. You know, we're a small company, so we all got to wear like 15 hats and we got to do a bunch of things. So it's hard for me to, it's hard slash impossible sometimes during those periods. So I used to kind of like, oh, you got to fight through. You got to get your words every day. You'll hear all kinds of advice from people. Like if you don't do it every day, you know, whatever. And I get that. You got to find your own rhythm. But for me, it's been at this season, I'm not doing that right now. So I'm not like actively every day writing a book right now. I'm thinking about how to share this next story and trying to fight for time to get back in the chair where I can get some momentum going again on the next thing that I'm writing. When I am like in manuscript mode, I'm working on it every day. Like it's the morning, it's got to be pretty early in the morning. I don't want too many things. I don't want too much decision fatigue. I don't want too much. I don't want to like, I try not to like check email and stuff, but I'm at my best. I try not to check email or look in any kind of social stuff. I just try to get there with as few decisions as possible. The only thing that might happen, hopefully, you know, is like sort of like religious things in the morning, like prayer and that sort of stuff to try to, you know, that's an important part. But so I try to do as few things as possible to get a good chunk in and like try to get I'll set myself some kind of easy-ish goal, like 1,000 words or something. And I try to get beyond that, but I try to trick myself into thinking like that's enough. Because usually if I get that, then I get momentum and I get going. And then I'll try to do it. Also, I'll have a morning session and then I'll eat lunch, do a few other things. And then I'll try to come back and get another one in the afternoon is a goal. And if it's like towards the end of a book and I've got like a lot of momentum, then it's just like I might write almost all day. And just take breaks to eat and that sort of stuff. But my family sort of knows that that's a time when it's just like I'm a little bit out of commission if I can. I'm a big believer in like, you know, you still got to like be a human and you can't.
Yeah.
You can't just say like I'm an artist, therefore I can like break the rules of being like loving your neighbor and being thoughtful. I've heard a lot of artists, that's why I'm selfish like that. Why I'm a jerk all the time. It's because I'm a musician or because I'm, and it's like, that doesn't work. You know, we're all called to we have different strengths and weaknesses in the body of Christ, but we got to love each other and we got to show up. Even if it's hard or difficult or against our sort of nature, we got to conform. That's got to conform to Christ. So I don't want to paint the picture that I'm this like problematic child of like, doing whatever I want anytime I want, you know, my family just can take it or leave it. I don't really have that disposition, but my family's very gracious in giving me space toward the end of manuscripts, especially. And I've gotten better at communicating about that with my wife over the years. but she's fantastic. She holds the fort. I don't know. You don't need to hold down a fort. Is it a jumpy castle? It's not made of helium. You don't have to hold it. You hold the fort, right? I mean, you don't hold it.
That sounds better. That sounds better.
I don't know why we say hold down the fort. You don't need to hold down. You just hold the fort.
She had a part in Mooses with Bazookas. Did I see that correctly?
She did, yeah, for the audiobook. She's a really good reader. So she read one of the stories. We had a kind of an ensemble for that. And it's pretty funny, honestly. You should, if you haven't given that a try, that's a pretty...
We did just start it recently, and it's been fun because Abby, she's only 7, so I've had some of the stuff you have to explain. But then we were driving, and we'd finished. I think we finished the Archer Cup series, and we're looking for something to read. And so I downloaded the audiobook, and listening through the beginning of it, they were catching what we explained. They really, really enjoyed it. So, as far as how you write, I was talking to my mom who. She's like retired, but she loves your books too. She's read them all. She's like, you're going to interview them. I need to read them again. But she messaged me and asked this question that relates to writing. She wanted to know, when you write a book, do you logic out and plan out the whole plot and all the stories? And then like you dress it up with imagery later, or is it more just, it just like comes out and it's kind of organic as it comes out? Or is there a lot of planning behind this?
Well, that's a great question. You guys probably know the two, excuse me. The two sort of broad terms of like an outliner and a discovery writer. There's sort of in fiction, there's kind of people who are outliners, and sometimes people call those architects. And then there's sort of gardeners, like, oh, something's growing here, I'll kind of follow that along, you know, and it's not as rigid. Outliners, another term for that is planners and pantsers. Like, some people are planners and other people are riding by the seat of their pants kind of thing. Those are great. All terms, and everybody's sort of like somewhere in between usually, and I am too. I'm definitely not an outliner. I'm not a person who just like everything is planned out. But for most of my books, I'll have beats. So I'll write a little beat. Like, so I never write an actual outline like A, B, C, or 1, 2, 3, anything like that. But I was like, this needs to happen. Like, and I'll like almost like a little version of a scene. And I'll sort of put those in order a little bit. And then I'm always open to that changing because it's so alive. It's so weird. You know, it's like, so much of writing feels not like a thing to me anyway. I think to a lot of novelists, it feels not like something you're creating, but something you're uncovering, that you're like the first audience to it. And that's kind of part of the fun of it, is it's kind of like reading, you know, you're just sort of, oh, and I'm often like, wow, he did that. I can't believe he did that. What in the world? You know, what's, you know, that sort of a thing. The characters do feel alive. It gets, you know, it's a little spooky and you can take it in kind of a weird direction, but it does feel like, I'm not a big fan of Stephen King, but he has this metaphor where he talks about it sort of like a the bones of a dinosaur or something. And you're sort of, you're digging. And then you start brushing away and you're kind of like, oh, and you're sort of finding it as you go. And that is kind of how it feels to some degree. But I always have some kind of a notion about what's going to come. And then, but I'm just always available. Like the character of Helmer, like you're wearing a Helmer shirt right now.
He's like gotta be my favorite. I don't know. Pickett's great, but Helmer's got to be almost my favorite character.
Well, he's the most popular character. People love him the most. When I go around, like talk to students and stuff, and have like rooms full of people, and he will always get like the most hands for like favorite character. And it's so funny because he's a good example because he was just there. Like when I wrote that book, he was just there. Like he just showed up. There's this character, and you know, Lewis talked about that sort of like he saw a fawn and then it was carrying parcels, and the lion was kind of coming into his dreams, all that kind of stuff. That's kind of what it feels like. Is Helmer was just there as the kids came into the savory den, this little eating place, and he was sitting in the corner and he's like brooding rabbit, and I'm like, what's the deal with this guy? Like, why is he so then it's like, it's just sort of discovery of that, and then curiosity, like, then why I'm getting curious, why, and so that becomes backstory. And so that's where the oath came from, the my place beside you, my blood for yours, all that kind of stuff comes from these sort of questions. And I like stories that have like a history. Either, you know, Tolkien talked about when he was sort of like, why he doesn't like allegory, which I sort of agree with him, is he says, I cordially dislike allegory, and I always have ever since I was old enough to sort of sniff it out. I can't remember the word he used exactly, but he said, well, a lot of people mistake or confuse allegory and application. One lies in the purpose domination of the reader, and one lies sort of in the freedom of the reader. And I kind of think of that applicability is really powerful. But he talks about sort of the natural storytelling. there are things that pop up, they come up, and there's this sort of creative process that to me, like, I love how he, when you read The Lord of the Rings, I mean, he's the master of obviously inventing languages and history and all this stuff. But I always love stories that like Star Wars. You know, Star Wars felt different as science fiction because it wasn't clean. It wasn't clean metal and plastic. It was like bones and dirt. And it was a used universe, which is what we live in, a used universe, which has history. And so I think I always love that kind of thing. So characters and other kind of events or names of places, like, why is it named that? Why is it, you know, there, like, I know why Nick Hollow is named Nick Hollow. There's 10 books of the Green Ember series and nobody knows that. But I know why it's called. That's one of the first things you come across, is the place where the kids live, the very beginning, is Nick Hollow. Well, there's a story out there, I hope to come someday, that tells you why it's called Nick Hollow. And there's a lot of stuff like that. I know this universe and the history. So it's got to feel authentic. It's got to feel, you know, like it's connected to a past. He talked about, I prefer history, either real or feigned, over allegory. And I like that. I like that sort of his feigned history, especially with the more real it feels, the better. Even if it doesn't show up in the story, knowing about it and having it back there builds up the foundation. You know, it's almost like trying to read the New Testament without the Old Testament. Can you do it? Oh, yeah, you can. It's great. You can read John, but then read John and Genesis, you know, and you're like, whoa, this is a whole different, you know, you start seeing like, oh, this is a much bigger picture. You can get all kinds of stuff from the Gospels, but boy, pair the Gospels with the Pentateuch and you're just in this unbelievable story, this big comprehensive, adventure. And I think I just like that kind of thing. I like that having the bottom, you know, the bottom and the backstory is real important.
We'll have to hear about Nick Hollow one of these days.
Yeah, I hope so. It's going to be fun.
All right. Andy, you're muted.
Sorry about that, Tim. I was just going to say that I really liked Joel Clarkson, I believe, who voiced Helmer in the main four books. I thought he just captured the, I don't know what you want to call it, the snark and the turning of him by the end of the story. It was just really good, him and Pickett. So anyways, that's all.
He's great. Yeah, Joel's a wonderful performer, wonderful musician. Yeah, great. I think he did a fantastic job.
Andy, you got a question?
Is there a book that you want to write someday? Like, you've got irons in the fire. You're an author. You probably got lots of ideas. Is there one that you're like, I really want to write this book one day, and you just haven't had a chance yet?
Yeah, there's probably a few. There are a few. I know.
Nick Hollow.
There you go. Yeah, it's so I think the thing that I've been thinking of more and more lately, I love it when people, there's always something authentic about, you know, all of my books have some kind of connection to me, my home. There's some that are more like the characters in the Black Star of Kingston, they're coal miners. That's really closely related to sort of like West Virginia and that kind of thing. So then there's always going to be stories that the Found Boys, which is coming out in September. That's another one that takes place in the 80s in West Virginia. It's kind of my childhood kind of thing. There's not a fantasy element to that at all. Jackson and the Waylanders Keys, definitely another sort of story set in a small West Virginia town. So those things are West Virginia and this area of the world and places I've been and lived are really important to me. And those are already showed up a lot in my writing. But I would say I want to be able to someday write a really truthful, faithful, beautiful story about West Virginia that invites other people in the world to see what I see a little bit. And I don't know what kind of story that's going to be yet. I think about Cry the Beloved Country, which is one of my favorite novels by Alan Paton. And it really tells the story of South Africa in an incredible way. Beautiful. And you just, I read that and I think, oh, that's that place and those people. And I don't think there are a lot of, Wendell Berry maybe does that for Kentucky in a lot of ways. And there's just, I don't know, there are people that do that for a place and for a people. And I would really love to be able to have the capability of doing that someday. And I sort of like, I noodle on that sometimes.
Do you see yourself ever writing nonfiction, or fiction is your thing?
Yeah, I've written a couple little nonfiction sort of things. Nothing that's come out yet, but yeah, I think so. Maybe someday. Sometime. It's a little bit daunting to me. Like, it feels like you guys, this is your setting, but like, it feels like the academic setting is a little bit intimidating to me. Of like, citing your sources and all that. I would rather invent another world than have to like figure out where stuff comes from.
And creating another world is a little daunting to me. I'd much rather cite some sources. So
you guys are on the other side of the teeter totter on that one. It's perfect.
Yeah, like, we are
bringing balance to the force.
So one of the things about Green Ember, I was noticing, I loved how you encouraged boldness and courage in the face of danger, but then also brought in the beauty and the virtue, which is one of the aspects of your So like the first book, I read the first book to my children, and then it was a conversation point. And that was one of the things I highlighted on multiple points. So how do you bring that out in your books? Like this old school virtue, because I think that's one of the things that really makes your books stand out, is that, hey, there's beauty in this world that God wants us to enjoy, and it's worth fighting for and preserving.
I appreciate that. I think that's true. I think that's true about the stories. I will say I don't think not very much of that is intentional. As in, I don't think about a list of virtues or even a feeling or what I want to evoke, and then try to think like, how do I get this into the story? It's again, Tolkien talks about stories bubbling up from the leaf mold of the mind. It's like a forest where tons of stuff is dropped down, you know, all kinds of leaves and acorns and animal droppings, and everything in the world's full of this sort of, but then things grow out of that leaf mold. And that's like sort of all of life. So I think it's like, it's kind of what I care about and who I am and what my family is and this place and people and love. And I mean, if you're, you know, you guys probably know as Christians, it's going to like ring a lot of your bells, because that's like, that's what I care about. That's who I am. I care about the kingdom of God. I care about anticipating the kingdom of God. So was I thinking when I wrote the book, I need to write a book that helps kids anticipate? I wasn't. I was thinking like, what's a cool story for my kids? So I didn't, I almost have to wall it off in a way mentally. I know I sort of have to trust that God is going to be at work and he's going to do things in the story through my experiences and what I'm like taking in to my mind and heart.
Well, I think that's huge. That's like very helpful in that basically it's kind of just an outflowing of your theology. It's an outflowing of your grounding in Christian virtue. So I don't know. That's kind of interesting to me on a couple of points. One, I thought it was a little more intentional. But you're actually telling me it wasn't that intentional. It's actually simply an outflowing of who you are as a Christian, as a believer in Jesus the Messiah. So that's really helpful in thinking through just that creation of virtue.
I would say, yeah, it's not intentional, and it's also not accidental. I would say it's not. I'm not. I'm aware somewhat. You know, but the wall for me is it has to work as a story. Right. So I'm never thinking like, oh, I've got to have a messianic character, and I've got to have, it's just like, it's got to come in. It's got to come in naturally, and it's got to make sense as a story. The good news is Christianity, I think, of all the story sort of systems in the world, is the most, I think, logical and comprehensive. As in, we always think, oh, Christian stories are really narrow. And I don't think that's actually true. I think that Christianity accounts for reality in a way that nothing else can, I believe.
Amen.
I think that, that different worldviews, Buddhism, for instance, is very, very limited, you know, in the kinds of stories you can tell. But you look at the scripture and you think about, there's tragedies. You can tell a story just about sin, about like what it does. And it could like go great for a really long time. It seems to, you know, the Koheleth in Ecclesiastes is like, what's going on here? You know, the people seem to be doing it. There's all kinds of corruption at every level, and doesn't seem to, you know, that's a Christian story. It's a very faithful Christian story. And we've got this sort of like, there's a big, you could tell the story of Absalom. You could tell a story, which most people think of Christian stories, like somebody was doing wrong. Then they did the right thing and things worked out for them. Like, that's not as much there in the Bible, but it's, you could have that kind of story. That seems like the only kind of Christian movie people maybe want to tell. But this is Christian worldview is super comprehensive of storytelling. So I don't have to bring a whole lot. Like I feel like I have to bring myself to it. And like, I want to tell a good story. Like, I think so many Christians think, oh, people like movies. And that's very influential. I think I want people to know about Jesus. Okay, so I shall make a Christian film, and people do the same thing with novels. Like, oh, people need to hear the truth. Oh, I know the truth, and people like novels, so oh, I will do that. But it's like, it's disrespectful, and I think of sort of the doctrine of vocation that God has made people, and you know, you wouldn't do that to a coal miner or something. Like, I can do that. Or like, it's a little bit disrespectful of vocation that God made. I just believe in the doctrine of creation, I guess, not just redemption. I believe in the doctrine of redemption. It's awesome. It's the coolest thing ever. But also, God made the world, which means that he calls farmers to farm, and he calls mothers to make a sandwich, and fathers to clean up, a mess, and to change a diaper. And like, we have to, and you don't, and I say, it doesn't make my when I make my kid a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, if I put a cross on it, it doesn't change.
It's a holy sandwich. It's a sanctified sandwich.
That's fantastic.
Like, I don't have to do that because God already made the world. So it's already Christian. It's already good. It's like he's in charge. Yeah. So I have to say yes to that when I approach the there's so many horrible Christian novels, and so much art is because we think we can dispense with that. And Flannery O'Connor talks about that. Like, she says, because we have like right information that we can dispense with this challenge of like portraying reality, a penetrating concrete reality, a penetrating, like a, basically like being good storytellers. And we just can't do that. So I try to keep up the walls as far as I try to say, like, I want to be a good storyteller. And like the fact that I'm a Christian, I have to trust God that he's going to be at work in what I do. And not everybody has to do that. I like it when somebody tells a story in a sermon to like illustrate something. That's awesome. The Lord did that. It's great. And I'm not saying nothing. I actually think lots of different stuff where like church skits work. They're like, I think it's great. Youth group skit, fine. That's cool. Do it. But pretending like that's Shakespeare is different, you know, and there's something that you get in Shakespeare or Jane Austen or Charles Dickens that you're not going to get from a church skit. And actually people can sniff it out. People, you know, when people use us or even forms that we care about as a utility, as a weapon, we sniff it out, and we sniff out the inauthenticity. And I wish we would be more aware of the doctrine of vocation and the doctrine of creation, and we would receive from the Lord that it's all his stuff, including writing novels, writing plays, painting, films, that like it all belongs to him, and that we can rest. And we also, I mean, I have enough faith in a big God that he's not waiting like, oh my goodness, if you had just put the plan of salvation in chapter 32 of the Green Ember, tons of people would have gotten saved. Instead, you blew it, and everybody's now they're going to hell because of you. I know a lot of people that basically think that. And I don't think that's true. I think that it's better to like, you know, I don't know, David Robinson. You guys remember David Robinson when he played basketball?
Oh yeah, I remember David Robinson.
Great Christian and a great player. Always use the example of like, if he's going down the court, like what's the best way for him to be a Christian and be a basketball player? Like if he gets an alley-oop and dunks the ball, you know, should he fall to the ground and take a knee and point his finger to the sky and say, Jesus saves, there's no salvation only in the name of Jesus? Is that the best thing for him to do? Or is it better for him as a Christian to get back on defense? And I was like, you should play defense is what I think. But wait a second, you're not proclaiming the gospel. Yeah, you're doing your job. And like, it's okay because God made the world. You can do your job. It's fine. And so I believe that about storytelling. Maybe it's not so simple as that. I believe in creation, that God made the world and that we can do these things. And as a result of that pretty robust view of trying to be a faithful storyteller, I do think that God is at work in stories like that. And I actually think that, and a friend of mine, Heidi Johnson, she says, instead of those kinds of stories, they're sort of faithful, have the biblical sort of faithful Christian imagination taken to authentic storytelling, that those aren't an escape from reality. Those are an escape into reality. Ooh. And that's what I try to think of my storytelling. I want it to be an escape into reality. And that's my prayer. That's my goal. And I pray that the Lord, and honestly, the Lord is doing that, and that he's giving good gifts through that.
You've really thought through this a lot more than I even imagined, like having a gospel in the story or whatever, and that would need to be there. That's completely not even what I never even thought that would be. I don't know. I would have never criticized you for that or even expected it because of its nature and what it is. So that's kind of a interesting problem that I wouldn't even known had existed.
And you know, when you look at some of, I can see names on some of the books behind you. You know, when you think about, you know, Lewis and some of his friends, you know, they each had kind of differing, I think, skills to this, where, you know, you can listen to Tolkien, you know, talk about a tree for 4 pages and you're kind of wondering what's going on. And then, you know, here's Lewis where it's like, it's a lion who's going to die for you. And then, you know, and it's a little bit more overt, But then you come to like a crazy dude like Barfield, where he's just like, let me just force my ideology down your throat while you're reading this. And it's like almost not even a story anymore. But yeah, I so resonate with what you just said. That's a great perspective.
How did you stumble into, you know, rabbits? And I mean, that's just kind of a random animal. I mean, you're in West Virginia, so I'm guessing the little boogers are all over the place. We have a lot of rabbits out here too. But
little boogers.
Honest, I have to, you know, it's been a bit of a challenge with me because we have rabbits in the garden and it's a problem. And there's a way to take care of the rabbits. And here we're reading Green Ember and it's about rabbits.
Well, he would be on, and Tim would be on Morbin's side when he takes care of the rabbits.
Yeah, Tim's just a big bad wolf.
How about the rabbits?
I kill more rabbits in my stories than you ever will. So there's
that's so true. You are correct. You have done that.
The rabbits, so a lot of people are like, oh, you must be this big rabbit lover. Like, you must love and know everything about rabbits. And that is not the case. The rabbits came about because I was sitting on the porch with my daughter and it was story time. And I used to tell her stories, used to make up stories all the time for her. And she was an older sister. She had a little brother and there was a baby on the way. And so I told her a story about a sister and a brother, rabbit. So I would call myself a rabbit Calvinist because I didn't choose the rabbits. The rabbits chose me.
How about that?
That is awesome.
So,
way to bring your theology into it.
This is finally the perfect podcast for that joke to pay off.
That was great. That was great.
And they are great. So again, I think that's another instance. Like a lot of this stuff is like, honestly, the Green Ember stories resonate really deeply with people who are going through a lot of pain. Like kids, I've talked to a kid this week who has cancer and he's laying down and I'm talking to him and we're just having conversation and he loves the Green Ember. I can't tell you how many people like that are out there. It's so much. And it's just an example of it because it's comforting. These are brave characters going through difficult things. If it was more of a traditional Christian story where it's kind of like, I'll pat you on the head. Yes, everything you think is right. And no, if you just do the right thing, nothing bad will happen. And like a lot of the sort of safe for the whole family stuff that we have encouraged sometimes as Christians, I like the dangerous element of it. I think it resonates with people in pain. But my point in sharing that is an example of that, something that I did not plan. So I didn't have the capacity or the brilliance or anything to say like, you know what, I'm going to make something that really blesses kids that are. No, I told a story. I was trying to say yes to what the Lord was giving me, I think. And he is doing crazy, amazing things with it out there that are serving people that are really vulnerable, who I really love and I want to give good gifts to. And I think even the rabbit stuff like that, that was something that, again, I wasn't clever and thought, you know, what's really cool, rabbits, but they're great. They're perfect because they're so overlooked. They're underdogs. They're weak. So it's got this whole sort of like God chooses the weak element, you know, to change why it's got this whole like they're really natural. There's they do have a lot of gifts, but they're timid, and so it's like so many things that I would want in a story if I had chosen are there. And I feel like that just all along the way there are tons and tons of those like mile markers of like, oh, the Lord knew better than I did, and I was just like maybe awake or said yes or just trying to pay attention imperfectly. And he's doing cool things that I could never have imagined through it. And the rabbits are like a little small example of that, but it really resonates with people big time.
Well, I would like to just chime in and say that I agree. This is going to go a little deep pretty quick, and don't worry about it. So my wife got diagnosed with cancer a year ago, and in November she died. And she went into hospice in September. And so as we were walking that incredibly dark, hard path with my two young kids, I remember thinking, I want something that I can be doing now that would carry them through mom's chemotherapy treatments. And then and then at the end it was, well, until she passes and goes to heaven. And so we had started listening to the Lord of the Rings. But let me tell you, like Hobbit is a great kid story. It's a really good kid story. But Lord of the Rings, listening to it is a bit of slow down and explain to a 6-year-old. But that's part of why I switched to the Green Ember. We had started it with mom, and then we were waiting while she was in hospice. But we had to drive 20 minutes down, 20 minutes back every day for like 4 months. And we blasted through a bunch of Green Ember. And it really was resonating more because I think of the path that we had to walk that God had stewarded to us. And I just want to tell you, I'm not trying to get pity or anything, but it was a really hard path, but it was very like, I think what I wanted my kids to know is this is hard, kids. This is really hard. But in the most loving fatherly way, I wanted them to understand that we're not alone in this. There are people who go through really hard things, and God asks us all to face those. And sometimes we don't know about all the other ones. And in a really weird, small way, these stories, it's almost like it gave them, it kicked their mind out a couple of feet to know like, oh, hard things can happen. Oh, bad things can happen. And it was just rabbits. But like some of these characters making the ultimate sacrifice, and some of these characters like being weak throughout it, there was no one-to-one comparison. There wasn't like I walked through it. But that as a background story and soundtrack to what we had to walk through really was timely and from the Lord. So I'm very thankful that you wrote this. And it was interesting that you just brought that up and said other people who have gone through suffering has resonated. I would be one of those. It was a wonderful story to read. And now past all that, God's brought great healing in my life. I've since met a really great Christian lady. We're engaged. God's been doing wonderful things in my life. It's not that I look back and I'm not sad about my previous wife or my children's mother, but I would say that whole experience has softened me quite a bit. And when I read your second and third, or your third and fourth book, I mean, I'm in the battle scenes and the sacrifice, the characters. I'm much softer than I think my kids are too. So, anyways, I'm very thankful. I just want to jump in and say that I really do think you've served people who walk through suffering. I really do, even though you probably didn't set out to do that. But it very, very good, very good.
Gosh, well, I mean,
sorry to make it. I know you got blindsided by that. I'm sorry.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Thank you for saying that. I mean, I just praise the Lord. I mean, that the Lord is good, and even in these tough times, I believe that there's something there for a lot of us that we think that our pain is, and because it's so hard, we think of it as an obstacle to doing good things or to accomplishing good things in the world. And it's just seems so often that the Lord uses our pain to produce good works, to produce good things that are gifts to other people. And I always come back and think like, would I have wanted it anyway? I don't know. I would probably never say yes. You would probably never say yes to the kind of pain that you've been through. But I am amazed at the Lord's goodness in superintending our lives and giving us good things. And honestly, as an author, it's almost like the only way I can sort of understand it, because I love Helmer. And I love a lot of these characters who go through really tough stuff, and I put them through tough stuff, you know, somehow. And that's the only way the story's good. And it's also the only way that the characters become the kind of characters that can do the heroic things that are asked, required of them in order to do these important things in the world. So I don't understand it all for sure. Probably why Ecclesiastes is my favorite book, because I'm just like, what is the deal here? This is tough. But it's I'm so grateful to God that even the comparatively minor pain, I would say, to what you've gone through of my life has been useful in to serve other people and to create something that served other people, especially vulnerable kids. That's an answer to prayer that the Lord, you know, I love these kids so much, and to give them anything in their darkness, to give them any glimpse of light. It was like, oh Lord, that is what a gift.
There's like me, and I don't want to, we don't have to, I know we're pressing the edge of our time with you, but and I want to give the scene away it's at the end of the first book or the end of the second book where Pickett makes a big mistake. And it costs pretty deeply. Yeah. And he's in sort of sulking. And your line, I can't remember which of the generals it is. He walks in and he's like, Pickett, we don't have time to indulge in self-pity. The way you said that was just one of those very timely things, like, oh yeah, when I'm in self-pity, I'm indulging in something. And just the way you talked about some of those things, I think it's planting a seed of like, oh, when you're in self-pity, you're like choosing to indulge in it. And then like right at the outset, when the thing at Nick Hollow happens with the parents, I mean, that was just low hanging fruit for us to like, and then I didn't even have to say anything. We kept reading. So anyways, all right, I'll back off. I think these other two guys got stuff they want to say.
Isn't that powerful though? Even those, your words there, I didn't have to say anything. To me, that's like the best of all. It's like, it's, and I don't mind. I love explaining. I love teaching. I love talking to my kids. And actually, I'm a little bit suspicious of people are like, well, if you have to explain it, it's not real art. Like, have you ever met a kid? But when it works like that, to me, that's the perfect kind of a thing.
It's supposed to be, they're supposed to have to think about it. That's Proverbs. That's like the way that we don't, it shouldn't have to be cookies on the bottom shelf. Anyway, I had to chime in.
And let me just say one more thing. I know I've said a lot here, but Lewis, I remember, I think someone posted this online a while back as a quote, and I have it on my wall over here. But Lewis was asked how an author goes about developing his own sense of style. And he replied and he says, by knowing exactly what you want to say and saying exactly that. And then it's like he goes on to explain it further. He says, I often think of writing as a shepherd moving sheep down a road. If there's a gate open to the right or the left, they'll surely go in it. And so the idea is that you write it in such a way that the only way the reader could take it is the way you want it, and you don't have to say anything when they think about it. I think you did a really good job so many times in these books, like with that indulge in self-pity one as an example, where you sort of cornered us. I don't even know if you intended it, but you cornered us to think about just exactly what I think you wanted us to. And it's just really good, really good.
Well, that's, I mean, and I think that's another example of the Lord being greater than bringing our gifts to God and saying yes to him and doing our best and trusting him for the rest. The old Keith Green song, you just keep doing your best and pray that it's blessed and he'll take care of the rest. I feel that maybe Keith Green doesn't have the best theology in the world, but I like that part.
That one was okay.
That was pretty good. But he does, he'll take care of the rest. And that's another area of him just of doing more. I don't know. It's like, it's
he's sovereign. We're trusting in his sovereignty.
He has this capacity to love, and be getting a window into that actually by receiving a lot of mail from readers and notes and talking to it, getting sometimes in signing lines, I'll talk to the kids will be either super excited and bouncing off the wall or like, you know,
like my daughter a bit ago.
That's normal too. I totally get that. But then like the mom or the dad is like crying like, let me tell you, I lost my son, you know, 6 months ago, or we went through this terrible thing. And it's like, I've had that thousands of times now. Mm-hmm. So it's getting a little bit of a glimpse of what the Lord is actually doing. And it's so far beyond my capacity. And I know we often in our vocations feels like we don't often get to see so much of like what the Lord's doing, but I've been blessed to get, and probably because the Lord knows how frail I am and how much encouragement I need, how pathetic I am. So it's been a blessing to kind of get some of that feedback and say, oh, wow, the Lord is like loving these little kids and these families. Like if you could do something for one kid, I like coaching soccer a lot. And it's like, if you can see a little change in one kid, you're like, oh my goodness, my life has meaning, you know? But to see that happen with kids through this is just, and I know it's imperfect. Like I know, like, I think your 8 was really generous. Like, that book is not the best book. Like I know there's so many books, and I'm not looking for anything here. I'm just genuinely like, I know so many people are better writers. So it's not exactly the writing. It's not like, oh, he's such a brilliant novelist. Like, I know it's not that. It's okay. I'm fine. I'm not like, oh my goodness, this is horrible all the time. But it's like, but I know where I am on that scale, I think. But it's more than that. It's the heart. It's there's other stuff. It's the pain. It's what the Lord's doing in it. It's just an incredible and huge, huge, huge honor to bless kids in this really chaotic, confusing world. Provide a little bit of clarity, a little bit of light, a little bit of hope, a little bit of like loving what and who we ought to love, like to give a push in that direction, move the needle of their affections toward God.
Yes.
That's a friend of mine who works at Disney, that's his like motto for himself, like what he wants to do in his life is like move the needle of her. And I'm like, that's, if you could, if the Lord can say yes to doing that, it's that, what a, so that's a miracle to me.
Tons of thoughts. We have more questions that we wanted to ask. We'll probably just have to reserve some of them. You do have another book coming out, and so we'll probably just have to line up another time to do some more fun like this. I do want to ask one final question for you here, and then Tim is going to wrap up our time. But before I ask that, and before Tim does that, Sam, we do just again, from the three of us, we have all appreciated your work, and it's just so fun to talk with you and, you know, in the power of Zoom, get to meet you. And yes, so thank you again for being on our podcast. We really appreciate it.
Oh, goodness. This was so fun, guys. Thank you so much. And yeah, I'd love to come back. We should. It was really cool to talk to you guys. Sorry, I get all blabby and start talking too much. But
Tim does that all the time. We're used to it.
No, we're really thankful. Thank you for writing. I think you're a really good writer. One of my favorite lines, I wanted to tell you this before we got done, was when you described Red Eye Garlickson's voice like grated gravel. I think that was like, I've never read a line and thought, I know exactly what that's like, having never thought of that before in my life. That was just a beautiful line. So you really have a great craft, and then you can see the eternal and the true and the good in it. And so we really appreciate it. So thanks for coming and interviewing. We were really, really excited about this interview. So thanks. We appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate it, man. I'm so grateful for you guys. That's very kind of you. That I'll give you. That was a good part. That was a good one.
That was really good.
A lot of them, but I'll take them wherever they are.
Here's our last question. And so if you could go back to yourself at the beginning, before you publish anything, when you're starting to write these series, and if you could talk to yourself before you started all of these projects, before you started publishing, and you could say, hey, you need to change this one thing, something you're doing now that you wish you'd been doing the whole time, what would that one thing be?
This is such a convicting question, because I like, immediately evaluate my life and think like, are there very, very many things? Like there should be more things. There should be more. I should be. But I think I have to settle on, I would take a walk every day, at least one walk every day. And that's not very spiritual maybe, but I actually think it is. Because movement is so important for writers, getting off our backsides and getting moving. It's so bad for us to just sit and write or read nothing. It's so, and that's not just physical, that's mental, emotional, that kind of stuff. So like if you could give a pill that would do what even moderate exercise does for us mentally, emotionally, all that kind of stuff, it would be, you know, you'd be a billionaire, be able to package that, but we've all got it available. So walking, and it's so good for us, as writers to be able to kind of think and move and just, I don't know how many story problems have been solved on walks and how many sort of clever, interesting solutions to problems, all kinds of have happened on walks, besides just the fact of being able to see creation and you live in a beautiful place like West Virginia or Iowa. You know, it's good to walk and to see and to smell and to experience that. So, and also it's times when I go with my kids, so I'd always invite people, come on. And so to walk and talk with my kids. If nobody goes with me, it's a great time to observe, pray, think, plan. So I do that more regularly now than I did many, many years ago. That is probably, was literally probably the one thing I could think of. There probably are others but you're talking about every day. I don't know if I do any good habits every day as much as I should, which is a good point of conviction. But yeah, take a walk. I would say, hey, dude, take a walk every day.
Yeah. I mean, think about what Jesus did. He went up in the mountain.
I think what you're trying to say is I'm a lot like, is that what you're getting? Okay. I think you're hitting me. I get it.
I think that's what he said. You got to go with it. You got to take it.
There's some strong similarity.
take compliments from Tim in whatever way you can get them.
That's the one thing. Jesus and I both walk. I mean, that's the
Go up into the mountain and pray. There we go.
So we're ticking off a few really key things. I'm getting there, guys.
Yeah, we don't have mountains in Iowa, so I mean, we can't even do that part.
Oh my goodness, that's why we're so spiritual down here. I knew it.
You have all the high places. Oh boy.
That works both ways. That works both ways.
Okay, Tim, can you rest from your puns for a moment to wrap us up, please?
Let's have a final thought from God's word. So we love Ecclesiastes as well. I've taught Ecclesiastes. Charlie's taught through Ecclesiastes. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. We all go through difficulties, trials in this world. The Christian faith has a way of handling those trials. Life is not simply a trial, though. Life has good things. In fact, the book of Ecclesiastes, in the midst of all of the vanities, in the midst of all of the trials, there is a portion that's given to each individual. Ecclesiastes 2, verse 10, I'm going to read just a portion of it. For my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward or portion from all my labor. Solomon had a portion. He had a lot, more than anybody, more than us, more than you will ever have. Yet in his abundance, guess what? It brought him unhappiness. In verse 11, it says, then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on all the labor which I had toiled. And indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. His exhortation is to enjoy, enjoy contentedly, enjoy the good blessings of God. He states in Ecclesiastes 2, 24 through 26, nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For who can eat or who can enjoy apart from him? God is the source of true joy, being content with the portion which he has given, which is enough, is the way to joy. Yet in the midst of the goodness of Ecclesiastes and the portion that God has given, there are times in life when, well, it's hard to see. It's hard to see any portion, any good. And in the Hebrew Bible, the book of Ecclesiastes is followed by the book of Lamentations. And in Lamentations, so you have Ecclesiastes and then Lamentations. Lamentations is a time where the portion is basically, well, it's nothing. The city of Jerusalem has been destroyed. All of the wealth has been carted off to Babylon. There's nothing. Yet, what does it state in Lamentations chapter 3, verses 22 through 24? 22, through the Lord's mercies, we are not consumed because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I hope in him. So whether the Lord has blessed you with much, be grateful and be content with your portion. Whether the Lord has blessed you with little, be grateful and enjoy your portion. But if you're going through a season of life where it feels like there's nothing, may the Lord be your portion. He is there. He is still with you, even through that time of suffering.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.